to order. Today is Wednesday, May 25th, 2011. The first item we're going to go to, we're going to skip out order, go down to a work session with invited testimony from Senator Johnson, please. I'm sorry, Senate Bill 360A.
Want all you people to listen up. Senator's going to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I have the privilege of representing Senate District 16. This ought to be a refreshing change of pace and a good way to start your agenda. I'm bringing you a non-controversial bill that passed the Senate 30 to nothing. It doesn't cost anything. In fact, it saves money in transportation costs and the expense of police officers to guard inmates. It expedites the process. It especially helps rural Oregon. It would allow the Justice of the Peace to do arraignments in the county seat, which with the exception of a handful of counties is not allowed, and it would allow our Columbia County JP to do arraignments in the city of St. Helens.
Any questions of the senator? Thank you, Senator. Close the work session on Senate Bill.
You gonna move it?
No, not yet.
We're ready?
Okay.
We're still in work session.
We're still in work session.
Mr. Co-Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 368 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger, Co-Chair Krieger, moves Senate Bill 368 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shelton.
Aye.
Representative Kinney.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Wisman.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries.
Thank you very much.
Who would like to carry that bill? Representative Wisman?
Representative Witt would like to carry that
bill. Yeah, that would be good. We will have Representative Witt carry that bill. Next, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 401A.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Senate Bill 401A would create the new crime of insurance fraud. This crime would be committed if a person with the intent to deceive or defraud provides false information or makes a false material misrepresentation in connection with a claim for an insurance benefit, fails to decline a benefit to which the person is not entitled, conceals from an insurer, or fails to disclose to an insurer the occurrence of an event which would cause the insurer not to provide a benefit, obtains a benefit greater than that to which they are entitled, or makes or causes to be made during an official proceeding a false material statement in connection with the payment of that benefit. This new crime would be a Class B felony if the value of the benefit received is $10,000 or more, a Class C felony if the value is more than $1,000, and a Class A if less than $1,000. This is consistent with the penalty structure elsewhere in the property crime statutes.
Irresponsible control of state property.
401 for schools. Okay, can we have Dan? I believe it's is it Tanel, Dave Kirby, John Wolf, and Bill Snyder come up. See if you can all get up there at the same time, please.
You can start anywhere you want, and just make sure you give us your name before you testify.
Thank you, Co-Chair Krieger. My name is, and members of the committee, and Co-Chair Barker. My name is Dan Tanel. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland, Oregon. The firm I'm at is Smith, Fried, and Eberhard, and I primarily practice in the area of insurance fraud and insurance coverage cases. I'm a former deputy district attorney in Washington County, and I am very honored to be able to introduce not only three friends, but also three members of the public safety community in the state of Oregon. To my right is the police chief of the city of North Plains, who is Bill Snyder. Chief Snyder is a former police officer and detective in the city of Hillsborough and the city of Sherwood. To my left is Deputy Fire Marshal John Wolf with the Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, and also the past president of the Oregon chapter of the International Association of Arson Investigators. And to my far left is Undersheriff David Kirby with the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office and formerly with the Washington County Sheriff's Office. I have asked these gentlemen, along with others in the law enforcement community, to help me urge you to pass this bill. I've submitted some written testimony, which I will not go over again, but essentially this is a bill that is long overdue in the state of Oregon. We are one of three states in the United States, along with Virginia and Alabama, that do not have an insurance fraud crime. That fact forces our law enforcement community to try to pigeonhole insurance fraud that occurs every day in this state into other criminal statutes. And when I turn it over to Chief Snyder, he is going to give you the perfect example from an event that occurred this week in his city as to why this is a badly needed bill. Types of insurance fraud that occur in Oregon all the time can run the range from house fire, arson cases, medical fraud, staged burglaries, or basically fraudulent burglary claims, fraudulent theft claims, people that dump their cars when they don't want to pay for them. And Chief Snyder is going to give you an example of one of those that occurred earlier this week. Essentially, it's time, in our opinion, for Oregon to not be one of three states without this crime. This bill passed the Oregon Senate 26-1. It seems that it has broad bipartisan support, and it should be signed into law as soon as possible. I want to end my comments with two things. Prior to coming to the podium today, I spoke with Ms. Meyer, who's the lobbyist for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and she and I wrote out an agreed-to amendment to Section 1, Paren little c, which will fix some of the language on the first page of Senate Bill 401A. And instead of the wording that is on there now, we've written that up, and I could hand it to Mr. Knott, or I could read it into the record, whichever is most expedient to the committee.
Co-chairs, you don't need to read it. Just provide it to me after the hearing. Thank you.
And that fixes what we discussed ahead of time. Last week in Multnomah County, I had a two-day jury trial for an insurance carrier in an insurance fraud case where a gentleman had filed a claim with this insurance company for approximately his 10th or 12th auto accident. It was his third hit-and-run accident, and the evidence strongly showed that this event, as he claimed, seeking well over $20,000 from this insurance company, never occurred. There were all sorts of factual problems with his claim, and there was no criminal conduct that could clearly cover what he did. And after 25 minutes, the jury in Multnomah County returned a verdict in my client's favor, establishing that the event didn't occur. And without this crime, he is left to continue to do this without being held accountable other than through the civil system and from some very minor criminal statutes. And with that, unless there's questions, I'd like Chief Snyder to tell you about a call that he went on this week. And over lunch, he had to ask me, as a former prosecutor, what can we charge this person with? And I think this will highlight why we need this bill.
Thank you, Chief.
Afternoon, members. I'm very honored to be here. Thank you. So what Dan was alluding to...
You need to identify yourself for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
My name is William S. Snyder, and I'm the Chief of North Plains Police Department. So, Mr. Tell, basically, we were having lunch, and I explained to him that about 2 days ago, I received a call, telephone call, an individual that lives in our city, and he wished to report that he had his home burglarized. And Dan didn't mention this, but formerly I'd investigated fraud crimes for about 8 years with the Washington County Sheriff's Fraud and Identity Theft Enforcement Team. So I had a lot of background in these types of cases. Basically, on the telephone, what this gentleman was telling me really didn't seem very, it just didn't seem reputable at all. So I went and met with him. I took a Washington County deputy with me and essentially got there, and everything he was telling me didn't add up. He was very strong, basically, on letting me know what he was missing, but very loose about when the burglary occurred and when he discovered that the burglary had occurred. His wife was there. I spoke to her, and basically through interviewing them separately, I developed enough probable cause to basically go back out and approach this gentleman out in the driveway and tell him that I did not believe anything he was telling me, and that I really thought that he was just trying to pull a fast one. He was trying to make a report of a burglary that did not happen, and then after that to attempt to contact his insurance company, his homeowner's insurance, and make a claim for the missing property. This guy was in dire straits. He was losing his house. I think he was he's on Social Security, not making any money hardly at all, and I think they're just not making it. And I presented that to him, and after about 3 or 4 minutes of conversing with him, he admitted to me that he, in fact, did make up this entire claim, that he actually, no one had broken into his garage, and that the property he had listed on the piece of paper he was showing me was just property that he just made up. I, at that time, opted not to arrest him at that time. I wanted to kind of stew over the case and see what I could do and talk to Dan, because I knew that this was coming up, this meeting. And so I think the best I could come up with is that we could charge him with an attempt to initiate a false report. Initiating a false report is a Class C misdemeanor, and then the attempt, I guess, would be one click down from that. So maybe be like a violation or something, like a traffic ticket. And he was trying to claim, I think, well into the $10,000, $12,000 range for what he was supposedly missing. And so, I don't know, I just, I thought it was a bit odd, you know, to have to deal with that in that way. And I wonder if the DA will even charge on it, even though he was making, by my account, a very valid effort to deceive us and make me take this report. So, for what it's worth.
Thank you.
My name is John Wolf. I'm also very honored to be here, to committee members and chairs. I'm a deputy fire marshal with Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. For those of you who may not be familiar with Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, it's the fire district in the state that serves over 400,000 citizens, 9 cities, and 3 unincorporated counties of Washington, unincorporated areas of Washington, Clackamas, and Multnomah County. Dan also mentioned that I'm a past president of the International Association of Arson Investigators, and a current member of the Oregon District of the International. Here today to show support for this bill. We think, as Dan mentioned, we feel this is long overdue. This bill, should it pass, will help as a deterrent in the crime of arson by insurance fraud, and that would equate to less fires and, of course, and less taxpayers' dollars, and most importantly, to the safety of the public, safety folks that respond to these fires, and ultimately reduce and minimize the risk of injury and death to our fire and public safety officials.
Thank you. I'll be brief. My name is Dave Kirby. I'm an undersheriff with the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office, and in a prior life, I supervised the fraud and identity theft enforcement team. First of its kind on the West Coast, and I had the honor of working with the chief at that time. And when I came here today, I asked the chief, I said, what makes it difficult? Why do we need to create a whole new crime when we've got a full book of crimes already? And he relayed to me that story, and it brought back my recollection that many times, even though we have many, many laws already, some of those laws just plain don't fit, or they make prosecution difficult, or they don't provide the proper deterrent for what the person may be doing. I don't think any of us sitting here are real proponents of creating laws, because we've got a lot of them to remember already, so I don't think we'd come to you if we didn't feel that this was important. And so I just wanted to throw my support in for a law of this nature, and also thank you all for your service.
Thank you. Questions? Yes. Thank you, Representative Garrett. Please.
Would you characterize this problem as widespread?
Co-chairs and Representative Garrett, we were trying to figure out before we came up here who was going to field the statistics question, and I drew the short straw. I think you could get as many answers to that question as you had people answer it. What I can tell you is the national organizations that work on this effort nationwide, there's two primary national organizations, and the best that I can answer is somewhere between 10% and 30% of every insurance claim that occurs nationwide has a component of fraud in it. So if you extrapolate that out to the total dollars that are spent, which you know is readily available on the Department of Consumer and Business Affairs and other websites, you can see the magnitude and the millions of dollars that this costs. And there is a direct cost to consumers. When companies are paying these claims, that gets, you know, I think everybody would agree, probably gets passed down to us in increased insurance premiums. So I think that's a pretty high percentage.
Is there any reason to think that the rate in Oregon is more or less, I would assume we're about the same as the national average? Any reason not to think so?
Well, again, to respond to that, my opinion, solely my opinion, is I think Oregon is, I think there's more of a problem in Oregon, and let me explain my rationale. Oregon is surrounded by states with insurance fraud crimes. Oregon also has some insurance laws that make us an easy target, and one of those is our mandatory PIP that is in our auto policies. Every auto policy in the state of Oregon has $15,000 of mandatory no-fault medical coverage. And Washington is not a mandatory PIP state. Idaho is not a mandatory PIP state. And I don't want to try to profess what California's personal injury protection structure is. But the fact that insurers have to provide that level of benefit, we see, and I am currently involved in a very high number of medical fraud cases because of providers that are taking advantage of that structure. And so I think, and again, without the crime, without a fraud bureau, for instance, in the state of Washington, there is a unit in the insurance commissioner's office that investigates fraud statewide. There's also the same unit in California and Idaho. We are this island without a crime and with insurance laws that make it easier to commit these crimes here. That is my opinion.
Thank you, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dan, and actually, Chief Snyder, you can weigh in on this too, because I appreciate the description that you gave of the one individual.
Thank you.
I mean, I understand where you're describing initiating a false report with what occurred as you're out there, you're taking that report and everything. What happens if you have the individual who's just, I mean, being stupid? He's, you know, there's some intent on his part on wanting to take advantage of the situation, but just like what you were describing, he shares this is what's going on, you come out, you take the report, and all of a sudden he has absolutely a guilty conscience that comes in. He says, you know what, this is off, I'm wrong, what I'm doing, I gotta tell you, this is wrong. How does that play into this, for this being the crime then, for a time period for reporting?
You want me to start?
Are you following where I'm at?
Well, I think so, but I trust that if I'm not, you'll correct me.
Okay.
And co-chairs Barger and Krieger, Representative Olson, one of the protections I think that is good is something that came up from Ms. Myers in the Senate with from the Criminal Defense Attorneys Association, and that was to include the fact that the false statement has to be a material element. It has to be material to the claim, and it also has to be an intent to defraud. And one of the problems that's posed by Chief Snyder's story is, and what I counseled him is that I think you have a completed initiating a false police report, which is a C misdemeanor. And I voiced this earlier, do you have an attempted theft at that point? Is there a substantial step? And I think it's a fact question that if I were a good defense attorney, I would take that case to trial and I would argue to your jury, you've got a prosecutor here who has charged this C misdemeanor, which we admit to. but you have a prosecutor who's charged a C or a B felony, which is too severe for the substantial step, arguably, that my client did or didn't take. And and this is the problem that is posed by the gap in our structure now, is you don't have good crimes to fit the types of insurance fraud into. And I hope that answered your question.
That's good. Thank you.
Okay.
Any further questions? Representative Nolan, please.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I didn't. If you could go back to the question that Representative Garrett asked about, he used a subjective term of widespread, and you cited a statistic that was pretty broad. Can you remind me what study you were referring to?
Co-chairs Barker and Krieger, Representative Nolan, the two organizations that I was referring to that track these statistics, and where I turn when someone asks me a statistics question, because I try to avoid those questions because I think you can find a statistic for anything, with all due respect. But the National Insurance Crime Bureau has a website with a lot of information on it, and the National Coalition Against Insurance Fraud. And what I do when I want to go to those websites is I just simply Google those two, and I go to them and see where they're at in terms of statistics. And in fact, in my written material, we cite some of those statistics, and we reference the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud and the National Insurance Crime Bureau from where we got the statistics from our written material.
Follow up, if I might.
Follow up, please.
Who constitutes the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud?
I don't know if I understand your question. Who makes
up the coalition?
I don't know who the members of the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud are. I mean, it is an industry group.
Insurance industry?
Yes, is what I believe. But I would have to go to the website to look to see if the members of the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud consist of members other than insurance companies.
If I might follow up.
Follow up.
And I would imagine that they would keep records state to state, not just of insurance fraud, but of insurance claims payments. And I'd like to know if there's a difference in that experience between Oregon and, for example, its neighboring states that you cited.
I am not aware of any entity in our state that tracks insurance fraud because, one, it's not a crime, and I don't believe that the reporting of suspicious insurance fraud cases in Oregon, to my knowledge, do not go to the insurance commissioner. They go to the National Insurance Crime Bureau. I'm unaware of anybody tracking that specific to Oregon. And in terms of dollars paid out on claims, I would have to go to the insurance commissioner to find out if that's kept.
If I might follow up. I understand your point that Oregon doesn't currently have a law that separates insurance fraud from our... We have pretty extensive statutes on fraud itself, but this bill aims to identify a separate crime that is insurance fraud, not covered under regular fraud. But if there is suspicious activity in Oregon, you would imagine that it shows up in a disproportionate average claim payment or number of claims per 100,000 policies.
It
seems to me that if we're going to change the law, it ought to be based on some evidence that there's a problem that can be documented in Oregon.
Well, again, I'm not aware of anybody that tracks those statistics, so I can't answer the question. And I think the problem that's being presented is being presented by the number of letters from the law enforcement and community. The Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police has formally endorsed this bill. I don't think the law enforcement community would spend the time supporting this if they didn't recognize a problem.
Thank you.
Representative Nolan and co-chairs, can I weigh in just a bit of an answer? Dan has a lot of statistics here, obviously, that are larger statistics. And I guess I could testify to this from a kind of a real-world standpoint. spending the majority of my career in detectives for Hillsborough Police Department or with the Washington County Sheriff's Fraud Task Force, and being a certified fraud examiner through the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners, we learned very quickly through their statistics, and I can't recall them, I apologize, but that fraud crime across the board in all states costs taxpayers the most money. And then beyond that, from, like I said, from a real-world perspective, I can think of countless times that, as a detective. In fact, there was a case right when I left Hillsborough where we have individuals who are knee-deep in this type of crime. They've made the report. They're going through all the interactions with the insurance company. And so all the energy and time is being spent basically at fighting this person's claim. And from a legal standpoint, from a criminal legal standpoint, our hands are tied completely. I remember working with a detective that was very frustrated, like I said, at the time that I left Hillsborough, and I had seen this many times, but there was just nothing he could do. He knew that this individual had done this, he could prove it, but he couldn't charge him because the crime did not fit with what we have on the books. It just doesn't fit.
A follow-up, and I assume we'll be hearing from some other attorneys. I'm having a hard time understanding that if someone is perpetrating a fraud, that we can't prosecute that under laws that outlaw fraud.
And Co-Chairs Barker and Representative Nolan, there's a medical fraud statute that this proposed bill amends. There's not a general fraud crime statute in the state. I don't know if that's addressing your concern, but you can't, in terms of just, there's not a statute that's called fraud in Oregon in terms of a crime.
The closest thing that would come to it would be 165-800, which is identity theft, and that's the only real fraud crime involving a person misrepresenting their identity that goes down that pathway. I would not be able to sit here, and especially with 10 years under my belt of doing fraud-type crimes, be able to tell you that there's a general fraud crime that would kind of be a fit-all. There isn't one. There just isn't. The closest thing is you start getting into the theft realm, and it just is different.
Okay. Representative.
Thank you, yes, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'm surprised it isn't already illegal, but 47 states, other states do, so there must be some information out there of how frequently this happens in a state like Iowa, same population roughly, demographics are similar. And we're not going to move today. I'd just be curious about that. I mean, I support what you're trying to do. The lion thieving bastard should be, you know, rung up the in court for lying about, and then my premiums go up as a result of it. So, yeah. But I'm amazed that it isn't illegal. But there has to be some data out there showing.
Well,
what's going on in other states?
And Co-Chairs Barger and Krieger and Representative Schaffler?
Yeah, close enough.
Did I pronounce
exactly
it right?
Exactly right. Thank
okay.
You.
I'm sure there is, but I tend personally to stay away from statistics because you can find statistics to support. Anybody can find their own statistics. And like I said, I would just simply, if I were going to be asked to provide statistics, I would go to the two sources that are included in my material. I think that's the best place to find statistics, or the insurance commissioner's office. And like I said, that's where I would turn.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still startled by this. The comment about statistics. I studied statistics for many years, and I just have a hard time understanding your point. But I guess maybe the question is for staff, and maybe it's for somebody here. But I understand that this law deals with people who are trying to have a claim against the insurance company. Do we have any laws currently, or would this affect insurance companies that are fraudulently not paying out claims?
Co-chairs, Representative Tomei, existing remedies for that, where insurers are not adhering to the terms of their policy, will generally be handled, I believe, civilly. And I think there would be some causes of action there. However, this statute has nothing to do with that. This statute will not help you if your insurer is not paying you and they're supposed to.
Follow up, please.
Follow up.
Thank you. So then I'm assuming that the insured person would have to hire their own attorney, such as these attorneys that are representing the insurance company. They would have to hire their own attorney to sue the insurance company to get their claim addressed?
May I?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Co-chairs Barker and Krieger and Representative Tomei, in the state of Oregon, if an insured person claim is denied, they have a cause of action for breach of contract against their insurance company, and if they prevail, the insurance company has to pay their attorney fees.
Follow up.
But
they would have to pay, the person who was making the claim would have to pay the attorney up front, right?
Typically, that's... I do not mean to offend by that. We'll find a connection here, but at Seattle University, I was nominated to be the business statistics student of the year, and I could never figure out why, because it's just a statistics class, and I was doing it to fulfill my major, but... there's so many statistics out there, and in terms, that's why I don't find them to be persuasive to me in terms of bringing my positions forward. I think you need to hear real life examples, and that's why I don't have a lot of statistics in the material. But the websites that I cited would have all sorts of statistics. In terms of a person suing their insurance company to recover benefits that they were denied. That's the case that the trial that I had last week in Multnomah County. If I would have lost that case for my client, the client would have owed the attorney the money, and typically the people that are engaging those private attorneys are not paying them up front. Many of those cases, and again, I'm not privy to the attorney-client relationships that occur between the consumer attorneys and the consumers, but most of those, the attorney is not paid unless they win the case. In fact, there's a person that I work with routinely that advertises in the Oregon Bar Bulletin who will tell you right up front that he handles fire claims and he doesn't get paid unless he wins. So those people really are not fronting money up. They're not fronting the money for their claim.
That isn't, if I may, that isn't what I'm hearing from my constituents. So when you talk about not hearing facts and figures, but hearing actual case stories, I hear case stories from constituents frequently who haven't been able to get the money from their insurance claim. And this is the first time I've heard about fraudulent. Certainly I've read about it in the paper, people who make fraudulent claims. Sure. But I hear frequently from constituents who are having trouble with their. So if we're talking about real life examples, I could probably match you many times.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Kocher. Regarding Section 1, Paragraph 2, having to do with the severity of the crime, a Class B felony, sub A, a Class B felony, if the value of the benefit or the amount to be paid for the loss of recovery is $10,000 or more, Class C felony if it's between $1,000 or $10,000, a Class A misdemeanor if it's less than $1,000. I haven't seen the amendments. Of course, I don't know if this is going to be addressed, but my hunch is on that it's trying to track basically the theft statute. But what I wanted to hear some comment on is in order to commit this crime, you don't actually have to get the money. It's basically an attempt. And so in terms of matching it to the theft statute, what the state could charge would really be an attempted theft, which, you know, let's say aggregated theft, it's $10,000, currently a B felony, but because it's an attempt, it's a C felony. So what we've got here as in Section 2 is basically making the attempt a higher classification than the actual completed act, if you will. I mean, it's not matching up. I see you're attempting to match it up, but it's not matching. You follow me?
May I? Well, let me... And Co-Chairs Barger and Krieger, Representative Hicks, if you look, and let me use an analogy back at you. If you look at the forgery statutes, okay, you can utter a forged instrument, which would be a $20,000 check, and get no money. You're still committing that higher level of forgery this is a new crime. This is a crime of making a false claim. You don't have to get any money to get it. You are correct. You would not have to be given one dime in order to violate the insurance fraud statute. But in terms of the crime classifications, they were meant, and when this was before the Senate, this was discussed, although this is modeled on Washington's scheme. This law is very similar to Washington's scheme. And if you think about the efforts in investigating a suspicious insurance claim and the amount of time and money that takes for an insurance company. I have a case in Multnomah County right now where I represented an insurer, and the insurer engaged two investigators, an attorney in California. The insured moved back to Oregon, and then I was retained. I took the insured's examination under oath, which is a procedure that is like a deposition and is part of most every insurance policy. And we had very solid evidence that this was a staged claim. He said he went out, someone broke in and stripped his Audi. And he claimed $28,000 from the insurance company. He confessed under oath in front of a court reporter to buying this car, producing forged documents, and buying this car in order to commit a staged claim. And now we're trying to recover over $10,000 in the amount of time and energy and resources it took to stop that event. So this isn't a non-monetary crime. Just because the insured person doesn't get any money, you know, the amount of time and money that companies are taking to investigate these and the law enforcement time, I think justifies this tracking with the existing property crime statutes in Oregon, which would be theft, forgery, aggravated theft.
Okay, I understand. Mr. Tennell.
Tennell.
It's really the police that are investigating. It's a crime. It's being charged by the state in this case. I'll stop there. Sounds like you have a response.
Currently, the insurance companies are the ones that are doing most of these investigations. There are statutes in place that allow information sharing between insurance companies and law enforcement. There are statutes in place that require an insurance company to notify law enforcement when they have a crime relating to insurance that is taking place. But most of the investigation that takes place is done by the insurance companies.
I'm hearing your justification. I just want to point out for the committee's consideration that we are, in effect, by the letter of this law, saying that because the victim here is an insurance company, the crime is, in effect, elevated. That's the effect of Section 1, Paragraph 2.
The insurance companies aren't the victim. Every one of us in this room is the victim of this.
Mr. Fennell.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, briefly, I don't want to beat this to death. I'm just amazed. First of all, I support the bill. I'm with you guys. You're right. I want to help. And this has more to do with the procedure in this building than anything you're doing. After listening to the incredible effort it takes to investigate these, and I'm confident government officials will be out there going after these bums, I'm amazed at this minimal expenditure impact. I don't know where LFO, where they dream all this stuff up. If it's something you want and somebody down there doesn't want it, it's got $1 million tacked on it. If it's something down there they do want, then it has this on it. And I just wanted to express my frustration with that, Mr. Chair. But this is a good bill, and I look forward to voting for it.
Thank you, Representative Garrett. Yes.
Thank you. So does this apply also to health insurance as well as other kinds of physical insurance?
If you look at... Co-chairs and Representative Tomei, if you look at ORS 165692, currently is a crime involving a false claim for health care payments. There are amendments to that statute in this bill. So this bill would affect false claims for health care payments as well.
No further questions. I can recall in years gone by there was a case that the Oregon State Police investigated arson and actually had to wait. They had to wait till the insurance company mailed the check
And when the guy opened the mailbox and pulled the check, everybody jumped on it. And about statistics, I remember the case of the statistician who drowned in a creek whose average depth was 6 inches. Thank you, pal.
Thank you.
I love it.
And this agreed-upon amendment with Ms. Myers. Okay. Thank you very much.
We're not going to move the bill today. So.
Okay.
Next, to call Mr. David Sugarman, please.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee. My name is David Sugarman. I'm a board member with the Oregon Travelers Association. I represent consumers in consumer fraud cases, as well as I've been practicing law for 25 years and done a lot of automobile insurance claims over the years. We have some problems with the bill. Obviously, nobody supports insurance fraud. It's a problem. But there are a couple things I think the committee's kind of already touched on. Number one is I haven't heard anybody say that there is a criminal statute, existing criminal statute, ORS 164.085, which is theft by deception. And while I'm sure Representative Hicks can correct me, because this is an area he knows much better than me, my understanding is an attempt to obtain through false statement money, or an attempt to defraud an insurance company by making a false claim, gets you already, triggers your exposure under those statutes, under the theft by deception, including attempt. I was struck by a couple things. The one thing that struck me was kind of a disconnect between the stories and the legislation, and I have some concerns that I'll get back to from the consumer standpoint. But, you know, we start with the one concrete story, which is the, for lack of a better term, hapless guy on Social Security who, when confronted appropriately by law enforcement, says, yeah, okay, I didn't, you know, I live on a fixed income and I didn't really have this property and it didn't really go missing. Well, the way I read the statute is drafted, he didn't make an insurance claim. He simply reported to law enforcement. He made a false report. And the statute is drafted, I'm pretty sure it doesn't get to that. I'm also struck by Mr. Thienel saying, well, I had this claim in which there was this repeat player, and the jury was out 15 minutes and found for my company. Later in his testimony, he explained that that person was represented by a lawyer, because that occurred to me to wonder. We have all sorts of sanctions for lawyers handling frivolous lawsuits, and our courts know how to use them. So if there is no merit to a claim that goes that far, and an attorney is pursuing it, the defense, the insurance company, has every right to ask for and obtain sanctions for that conduct. Here's where I'm really concerned about this bill. It's not reciprocal, as Representative Tomei kind of alluded to. And there are problems with insurance fraud that go both ways. The committee may or may not be aware of the recent Oregon Supreme Court opinion in Strawn versus Farmers, which was a 7-year running consumer class action in which Farmers was systematically shorting consumers on insurance benefits. And there was a whole fraud scheme. This case went to trial. It went up on appeal and years and years and years. And eventually, Farmers had its day of reckoning. Now, one of the things I notice is that for the unscrupulous in the insurance industry, and I really want to make clear that I'm talking about unscrupulous, whether it's a company or a particular department or a particular adjuster, this gives an amazing hammer over a consumer who would otherwise make a claim. So, for example, if I am injured in a car wreck and I go and get medical care and my medical provider makes a billing error and my lawyer submits that, the insurance company that wants to use this as a hammer can say, by the way, unless you withdraw this claim, we're going to be turning it over for prosecution under the insurance fraud statute. The only other thing I'd like to point out is this notion of, and that's why I think, by the way, the statistic of 10-30% that Mr. Tennell hit comes from. Because my I'm not familiar with those statistics, but my guess is if you unpack them, they relate to claims that are questioned by the particular carrier. So, for example, if somebody has, again, garden variety auto accident, medical care costing, say, $2,500, medical care, physical therapy, whatever you have. And sometimes what happens is there's a dispute about whether a particular part of the treatment is related or a particular charge in that treatment is related. And while I don't know for sure, I would wonder if Mr. Tunnell's stats that he touched upon were packed into there. Last thing I want to touch on and then answer whatever questions the committee has is part of that hammer that the unscrupulous operators will get from this statute is an immunity for reporting. If a report is made by somebody and it is in good faith under the statute, they have absolute immunity. In other words, there's no pushing back. So it adds again to the package problem. I said one thing and I have one more thing. I guess I'm suffering from attorney's disease, and that is this. Representative Tomei asked about what an insured can do when the insured is not getting paid. One of the things that Oregon law also provides is there's no private right of action for consumers under the Unfair Claims Settlement Practices Act. So when an insurance company misbehaves and engages in, if it doesn't pay benefits, it should, we have the breach of contract remedy. But if they misbehave and engage in fraud, there is an administrative provision, assuming that the insurance commission has the funds and the facility and the resources to proceed. But consumers do not have a claim under the Unfair Claims Settlement Practices Act. And that's one more reason why I'm concerned about this bill kind of taking things further out of balance. I don't have anything further. I appreciate your attention. I'm happy to answer whatever questions you may have.
Any questions? Representative Tomei.
Thank you. This was concerning to me. Thank you, Mr. Chair, that the health insurers are also included in this. As I recall, there was an expose, I think, by one of the television programs that showed that at least one, maybe other health insurance companies, hire special people to refuse claims. Do you know anything about that?
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, and Representative Tomei, I know that typically insurance companies use all sorts of resources to review and investigate claims. We, as attorneys representing our clients, also have an affirmative obligation to review independently and do our best to ferret out any particular problems. The particular practices I don't have any insight into because I have never worked for or represented the insurance industry, but you do bring up another point, and it's important. There is a separate criminal provision for false claims for health care payments. So if there is a problem with health care payments being falsely submitted, and I have seen news reports where sometimes it's also the provider, there are statutes currently on the books that go to that. As far as how that's ferreted out, how it's investigated, how it's reviewed, I could perhaps find somebody for you. I'm not the person to speak to that in any detail.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any further questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Sugarman.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 401. And we'll, before I move on, I want to make an announcement, too. There's several bills where, and because of the mix-up at the early part of the meeting, we've been waiting for some fiscals to come in and so on that are not here yet. So 347 will be carried over until tomorrow. Senate Bill 405 will be carried over tomorrow. Senate Bill 557 will be carried over until tomorrow. And there we have to carry Senate Bill 924 over, as we don't have a fiscal on the Dash 8 amendments until tomorrow. Thank you. Open a major introduction.
And co-chairs, members of the committee, I have a LC 4213 dated 5/23/2011 and relating to contracting for correctional services and declaring an emergency, available for possible measure introduction.
Okay, thank you, Council. I'll entertain a motion to Co-Chair Krieger moves that to introduce LC 4213. Is there any discussion, Representative?
I'd like to know what this does and why we're doing this.
Okay, please, Council.
Co-Chairs, Representative Tomei, first of all, this is sort of, you remember the LCs that came in on the green slips early on, so it's coming in for first reading and passing it out. Here is just passing it along. It doesn't constitute any sort of an obligation to vote for it later. That having been said, this bill will make a modification to the rules governing incarceration, basically allowing the Department of Corrections to enter into a contract with a public or a private entity for the provision of correctional services, transfer of prisoners if needed.
Mr. Chair, we're just making this a bill. That's all we're doing, right?
All right. That's correct. This, yeah, voting to introduce to accept the introduction of the bill does not mean you support the bill. Representative
And Nolan? Let's be clear, given the time of the session, this is a bill that will not come back to us.
Any further discussion? Is there any objections to introduction of LC 4213? Hearing none, so ordered.
I don't know anything about it.
Thank you.
I'm not part of it.
Okay. And so, okay. Now we'll move on to work sessions. First item on the agenda is Senate Bill 75. Open a work session.
Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 75 comes here from the Department of Corrections. What the bill does, it removes the sunset provision that was placed on the provision last session that allows people who are in post-prison supervision to move to inactive status after they've done one half of their post-prison supervision. Chairman of the committee, you have two amendments in front of you. They both place a sunset provision on the bill. The dash one would say, go to July 1, 2015, say committed, convicted of a crime committed before July 1, 2015. The dash 2 would say convicted of a crime committed before July 1, 2013. We have the all the paperwork. We have the fiscal. They're minimal. In fact, it probably have to be positive. So the original bill removed the sunset.
And the dash 2s are for the two-year?
Members of the committee, let me read it. On page 2, line, restore the bracket of language, line 30, insert, convicted of a crime committed before July 1, 2013.
Yeah.
This has a positive fiscal of about 1.1 per biennium.
Okay. There are two amendments. One would extend 4 years, one would extend two. It's my preference that we go for the two-year, which is the dash two amendments.
So 2 years?
I'll sunset it for 2 years.
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, one amendment, the dash two is 2 years, the dash one is 4 years.
Yes.
So that's a sort of policy issue.
Yes.
And if I might, as between those two time periods, we've seen numerous times that a very short period of time, particularly in this kind of an arena, doesn't really give us a chance to evaluate the effectiveness of the policy. And 4 years makes a lot of sense. It's consistent with the way we approach evaluations through the Criminal Justice Commission. And I really don't see any reason to make it only 2 years. I prefer the 4 year.
Okay. I prefer the 2 years, so we take a look at it. If you think there's not enough evidence, if the economy is still not improving, it could be extended to four. And so that was my thought. Any other discussion?
Well,
you know.
It's a significant decision that should be contemplated, I think, by each legislative assembly. Rather than dictate to the next assembly what the policy should be, we should give them the option of deciding whether they want to continue on in this. So I do support the dash two for that reason.
If I might?
You might.
If that were the case, Representative, every single bill we passed would have a two-year sunset on it, and we would review shelves and shelves of statute every time. Every legislative assembly has the opportunity to undo what the immediately preceding or 100 years ago preceding legislative assembly did. And the intention of this is to give us an opportunity to evaluate this. And if we really want to evaluate it, I think we need to have enough time to see how it works. And many of these issues will run past that period. We already know that. So we won't get a legitimate evaluation.
Yeah. Part of this is that people on the, what this does is essentially kick people off the post-prison supervision pretty early, so they're not being supervised. They'll only be supervised for a very short period of time. And while it will be good to have a look at it over a four-year period, I think I, again, still prefer that we stay at 2 years, and that can be renewed at the end of two. So, open for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 75.
Representative and Co-Chair Krieger moves the Dash 2 amendments into Senate Bill 75. Is there any additional discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Only to say I think every 2 years we should review our land use and natural resources policies in this state.
So Representative softball. Schaffler is making my point for me.
You're right.
It's a conceptual amendment.
What do we call it? Go ahead and call the roll on this one, please.
Representative Nolan.
On the amendment, no.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Schaffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Wong.
Excused.
Representative Woodman.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
No.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 75 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 75 to the floor as amended to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion on the bill? Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Better than nothing. Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Schaffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Wong.
Excused.
Representative Wisman.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
You bet.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries. I'll carry it.
Okay.
So then the only thing we have left is 924.
I was just chilling.
Yeah, it's really cold, isn't it?
That's the first time I've ever
And I'm making public notice that we will be carrying the work session of Senate Bill 401, which we just had a public hearing today. We'll be carrying that over till tomorrow. And then we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 592.
Chairs and members of the committee, Senate Bill 592 was previously heard on the 11th of May and briefly on the 18th and 24th. An amendment was tendered from Representative Garrett, originally the Dash A3s. It was further refined in the Dash A4s. Dash A4s incorporate the Dash A3s just to include Supreme Court denial of a petition for review. So at each stage, the intent is to allow attorney's fees where they're allowed all the way up as they follow the case, regardless of the type of review. So that's what this measure does. It allows awards of attorney's fees. There's no revenue impact and minimal fiscal as to the Dash A5 amendment, and the amendment has yet to be moved in. I'm sorry, Dash A4 right. Has yet to be moved into the measure.
You figure out that.
Chair, I'd like to move the Dash A4 amendments into House Senate Bill 592A.
Co-Chair Krieger moves the A4 amendments into Senate Bill 592A. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 592A as amended to the floor if it do pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 592A to the floor as amended to the floor if it do pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Wong.
Excused.
Representative Wisnett.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hitt.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair
Barker? Aye. Motion carries. Representative Garrett, will you carry that for us,
sure,
please? Thank you. Representative Garrett will be the carrier. Is there any further business to come before the committee?
Yes.
Yes. Representative Wisnett, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would appreciate the chair's re-looking at the bill that we heard all the testimony about, and Representative Shoffler brought up the financial impact. Now, we're working here, the bill we just passed, is to try to save money in the Ways and Means process to balance this tight budget out. And I think we all like the bill, but there's no way under God's earth that there's not a financial impact by passing that bill from the first question that Representative Garrett passed. So if I'd rather it be done in the committee than go to the floor, you know, you have to demand that we have a send it down to Ways and Means to get it.
Which one are you referring to?
The insurance problem.
It has a subsequent.
Yeah, we haven't moved yet.
I know, sir, but I.
But it has a subsequent referral, doesn't it?
It has a subsequent referral. Two Ways and Means.
It does. Okay, I apologize. Good.
But we don't know what the dash, whatever amendments are going to be. We're concerned whether or not we get the amendments even back in time to get a fiscal.
Okay.
If they try to amend it, don't want it like it is.
It was a gut and stuff.
It could die.
It was a gut and stuff. So who's pushing that bill?
I would guess insurance.
The police were in favor of it, too. It was the police that were in favor of it.
It could all be my big problem.
Committee adjourned.